Welcome to the Performance Recipe Podcast with me, Richard Stewart, a performance nutritionist and personal trainer. We all know we can get tangled amongst the facts and fads on social media, and so the purpose of this podcast is to bridge the gap between science and practice by having industry experts on all topics performance related. I became a performance nutritionist because of my background in Michelin star restaurants and being a personal trainer, bridging the gap between food and fitness. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Welcome to episode 4 of the Performance Recipe Podcast. Next up, we have Benny Price. He talks about all things biomechanics coming from RTS Global, a world-renowned biomechanics qualification. Benny is an engineer, come personal trainer, and educator.
Hey, thank you so much for joining me. I've been watching your content for absolutely ages, and I really appreciate the educational purposes that you put out to a lot of fellow PTs and people right around the fitness industry. So I thought I'd get you on because I really do appreciate your area of expertise. But if you would like to introduce yourself, tell everybody about who you are and what you do, that'll be a great start. Thank you.
Cool. Well, thank you very much for having me on to go through this process, mate. My name is Benny. I am a engineer turned personal trainer, turned through that process, an educator. Because, and I'm still a personal trainer at the same time. I still practice what I teach. And the process of going from being an engineer to a personal trainer meant that when I stumbled upon RTS, I took to it like any kind of amphibious animal to water. And I was very, very comfortable with it. It was the missing piece to me. It was an absolute epiphany that I was able to mold both of those worlds together. And it's given me a very strong appreciation for and understanding of mechanics and how it applies to exercise. And so these days, that's what I do. I work for a company called RTS, which was really the first company under the guidance of the founder, Tom Purvis, to bring an understanding of mechanics to the exercise industry. And he first of all did that under a different company called NASM back in 1989. Oh, and wow. When that was sold, he started doing that for RTS in 97. And the reality of it is I am a professional regurgitator because everything that I teach, I have really taken from my learnings from Tom Purvis. I add in my background as a mechanical engineer that helps me maybe explain it in different ways, give it different context, and also the inspiration that my clients provide me with for problem solving on a daily basis and how I can use the manner in which I've worked with them and use these tools to help give it context to personal trainers and make it relatable to the problems that they might find with their own clients on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, 100%. Like I saw a post that you did not too long ago where you explained the different mechanics of a hip thrust, and someone commented, it's nice to hear your opinions on this. And your reply to them was, this is not an opinion. I wish I could give an opinion, but this is just biomechanics. And I thought that was a brilliant reply. It's just straight up logic. It's just the facts. It is what it is. And you make really, you take a lot of complex situations within the gymming environment when it comes to biomechanics, and you put it into context and you make it really easy to understand no matter what your level of knowledge is when it comes to, even when from a physiological perspective, because a lot of people think, tell me if I'm wrong when I say this, but I'm pretty sure at some point you said, like, biomechanics isn't necessarily going to go and like build you muscle, but it's going to make sure that you do things correctly, essentially. So you also differentiate the differences between physiology and biomechanics, which, I think that's something else that people can see a bit of a gray area and they get a bit confused with. But I want to go into a little bit of that in a bit.
That means a lot. Thank you very much.
So what is biomechanics and why do you think it's important?
So I would probably at this point make a slight differentiation between biomechanics, because biomechanics is really the study of movement and processes in organisms in general, right? You can, like, the way a duck digests things or there's a biomechanics element to that. What we and I teach at RTS is what Tom has defined from kind of the very initiation of him delivering this content to personal trainers is exercise mechanics. So it's really just taking the pieces of biomechanics that are relevant to the work that we do in the gym and studying those elements of it. Another big difference between exercise mechanics and biomechanics, with biomechanics just being, okay, so if we take the stuff that's relevant, we're looking at like the movement, right? We're going, okay, well, how are joints built? What are the structures that sit around them that maintain their integrity? And also, what are the things that help them move? And how do those things align to help them move in different directions? And how do the structures maybe provide limitations to what is beneficial in terms of which directions to move in or which directions might be a good idea to load in? That's kind of the majority of what biomechanics could tell us, especially if it was studied in the depth to which it probably should be under some surroundings. But the big missing piece there is if we look at how we define exercise at RTS, we call it, the definition that we use is internal force production in response to external force application. That's exercise under any guise. In any modality, that's exercise. The only difference that you're seeing when you go, oh, that's cardio, or oh, that's power, is just the magnitude of the force being applied, and as a result, how many times you can do something before you have to tap out. And whether or not it's the muscle that's tapping out at that stage because you just can't produce any more force, or it happens to be like your cardiovascular system that's gone, mate, we're done, before the muscles were able to do so. So under all these circumstances, though, it is a matter of producing force internally in response to external force application. And the thing that can be a bit of a confusing element to some people there is when they go, well, what about jogging? The earth, the globe, is constantly putting force back against you to stop you from sinking into the core of it. There is resistance being applied to the ball of the foot of someone who is jogging. So in all of these situations, we're producing force internally. Now, that external perspective on the application of force is something that we study quite a lot of, because that's a vital component to understanding the internal response that we're going to see. Very often in traditional biomechanics, we get distracted by the movement that someone's performing and which muscles must be involved in moving the joint in that manner, without taking into account the fact that the direction at which someone is being applied resistance is actually the thing that's going to define the majority of the stimulus and the internal response. I can do this movement right here, and it might look like a press or a pull, but the reality is that the load involved in this movement at the moment is actually the weight of my arms. And this is an isometric lateral deltoid exercise. It is not a chest or a back exercise, unless I started doing it really quickly and I was having to overcome the inertial effects of trying to throw my arms back and forth. But only with the perspective and the appropriate understanding of external application of force are we really able to understand what's taking place internally, and as a result, what stimulus we're achieving from exercise, and whether or not that aligns with our goals and also what the individual in front of us is capable of.
Jesus, what an answer, hey? Yeah, like, it's so nice listening it from your specific perspective, because how I, like, so when I did my master's, I did it in sports nutrition, which is not just nutrition, but it has a massive element of physiology. And it's just nice to hear just a different way of describing different outcomes. So what I mean is, like, I look at things from like a fatigue perspective, and like what metabolites are happening, and what's happening from a physiological perspective. But yeah, looking at it from what sort of forces are being applied at any given point, and looking at different types of, like you're saying now, for the different stretches, you've got isometric tension, and you've got where you're driving, what muscles are actually being worked, and how do you apply that. It's a slightly different frame of mind to what I'm actually used to, which is actually one of the reasons why I started following you guys at RTS, because there's a guy, is it Mark something, that lives out in Dubai. I think you've met him a few times. PT in Dubai.
But okay. We know a lot of Marks. Yeah.
A lot of Marks. He was always posting about you guys, and his knowledge is absolutely incredible. And so if anybody's watching this, definitely recommend following you guys, both RTS and yourself, and getting on an educational program. I think I'll probably do that in the near future too. Something else I want to say is, how would you say the mechanics differentiate from traditional anatomy and physiology, if there are any real differences, just for the viewers?
Yeah, I mean, I think the primary difference is looking at what happens to the mechanics of an individual when we apply force to them in different directions. Another thing that we will look at is it's impossible to know what's going to cause an injury to someone, right? Unless it's a matter of, you know, cracking them against the shin with a sledgehammer. But the stuff that takes place in the gym, it's impossible to study what actually causes injuries because people do stuff in their day outside of the gym, and we can't just tell them that they're forbidden to leave their bed other than for the 1 hour a day that we have them in the gym. So we can't really run that experiment. So what we've got to do is look for clues in the way that we're structured and what we see as being injuries that occur. And we've got to look at what parts of mechanics might lead to those injuries if joints are placed in certain positions under certain directions of the loading on a chronic basis. So that's a lot of what we'll kind of look for, because the goal here, as we do this strange thing in the gym, right, where we go, ooh, if I do this one thing over and over and over again, it yields a beneficial adaptation in this other thing. Great. Like, that's not really how humans evolved moving, right? So we've found a way to kind of hack this system. And then it's a matter of going, okay, well, how do we make sure that when we're doing that and we're achieving certain elements of stimulus and benefit, that we're not incurring a degree of stress or cost or tax that is going to build up over time and cause us to be in pain eventually, or to lose beneficial function of that joint when the whole point of it was to kind of improve the function of that joint. So those are kind of some of the perspectives that we look at. But the real goal with exercise mechanics is physiology is primarily looking at the second half of exercise. The way we look at it is you've got two parts, right? You've got the doing it, the stimulus, and then you've got the adaptation. And neither of them is necessarily more important to study than the other, right? There's plenty of value in understanding physiology and the adaptation outcomes that come from giving dosages of exercise to people and seeing what comes from it. It's not particularly useful in terms of understanding the outcomes of doing specific exercises, because when you often look at how exercise science is studied, that very little standardization and manipulation of how this thing is set up and executed takes place. It's just kind of like, oh, we got 100 people to do 10 sets of leg extensions, and this is what happened. Mm-hmm. Well, hold on a second. We need also, in order to have any relevance to this study, we need an understanding of mechanics. We need to know, were they all on the same leg extension? Because not all leg extensions are built equal. Were they all doing them with the same range involved, with the same tempo involved? Were they all using the same cue, or were some of them thinking, I'm going to squeeze the hell out of my quads, but the other ones are thinking, I'm just going to kick this leg extension machine and hope it moves? If without that element of understanding the stimulus, the adaptations that we're then studying at the other end are kind of polluted. So that's where you kind of see a big difference between the two. I think physiology is really important and applicable if we're understanding like athletic applications, if we're understanding endurance type training where we're trying to fatigue other systems of the body. And also when you start looking at the kind of like the nutrition side of things, because with nutrition, there's very much you can kind of standardize the thing that you're the ingredient, right? It's much easier to do than standardizing a rep. And also with the nutrition, there's a lot of stuff that from what I've seen, theoretically, oh, give someone more of this and they would improve at that. But it doesn't actually tend to be the case. And so the way that the body receives that and processes and digests it can be wildly against our expectations from what we thought about the ingredient. But with mechanics, the ingredient is the direction of application of resistance relative to the path of motion of the joint and its distance from the joint, which is going to affect like the magnitude of torque that gets experienced and all these factors. That is a cut and dry science. You know how earlier you were like, oh, it's not an opinion, it's a fact. That is why I like this stuff. I come from an engineering background and mindset where when I did exams in school, I absolutely hated history and English and all these things where I wrote down the thing, but it was up to interpretation as to whether or not that was right. With mechanics, what you have to understand as well, though, is that as a result, there's not a bad and good exercise for any person. You could look at the deltoid structure of any individual and see different insertion regions based on the structure of like someone's acromial hook. And that's going to dictate whether something is primarily like a middle deltoid or front deltoid or rear deltoid exercise for different people. And we're going to have to set them up differently to align things differently and achieve different outcomes. So there's not a black and white, this thing is good and this thing is bad, but there's a black and white, if I set things up in a certain way relative to my understanding of an individual, I will be stimulating this portion of musculature because that's just the way physics works.
Amazing. And it's so true. Like what you were saying a little bit earlier on to your statement was, when it comes to a lot of these studies, for example, when you're saying someone, let's say you had 10 people performing a leg extension and they're going 10 sets of 10 reps. Now, something else I've noticed, so the question I'll come on later on is about certain exercises you see doing wrong in the gym, which we'll get to. But
okay.
let's say you've got 10 repetitions. Now I have one person, they see progressive overload is like, you have to get a certain amount of reps. You have to get a certain amount of weight or increase it every single time. But the reality is progressive overload is a much broader scope, in my opinion, at least. Because if I said to a client of mine, okay, today you've got to get 10 reps. I know they really struggled on the 8 reps. And let's say they're going at a tempo of 3, 2, 2, 1. I don't know. Let's just make something up.
Mm-hmm.
By the time they get, because they know they have to get their 10th rep, they're going to end up cheating on those last 2 reps because they're struggling. And that completely changes the mechanics. Their bodies are moving, the speed at which they're moving, all has a massive impact. So how is that true reflection of progressive overload? So yeah, you're right. So there's so many different things to have a look at. And then, like you said, it's all about context, right? And how do you put that into perspective? It's all, as a practitioner, we need to be very cautious of these things, be a lot more specific. But it's a science, right? And with science, we like to be sure of what we say and what we do. So part of this podcast that I've started, I've tried my best to get practitioners who are all evidence-based, people with science-based backgrounds as well, because I know they just have a high degree of critical thinking. And I think it's nice to have actual experience and actual people that use genuine knowledge as opposed to anecdotes every single time. So yeah, that's the focus of this, right? But then moving on from that, that was an amazing answer, honestly. Thank you.
Just a quick break. If you find this information useful, please like, subscribe, and send this to a friend. Otherwise, let's get back to the conversation.
So what are common applications in biomechanics, exercise mechanics that you would do in sports and rehabilitation?
Okay, sports and rehabilitation, I'd probably separate the two of those. The thing that I think is often misunderstood, and I delivered a talk on this a couple of weeks back, is with rehab, one way that I kind of define someone who's in rehab, okay, so there's someone who's got an injury, right? And if someone has an injury, they've effectively just got a reduced ability to produce or tolerate force through joints or musculature, right? They've either injured a joint or injured the muscle, and that's just reduced their ability, i.e. they've gone back a few steps. Now, if someone was a beginner, and beginners have reduced abilities relative to you and I, what would we do with them? We'd start them with what they were currently capable of, and then we'd progress that until they got to be capable of more. And the only difference really with the way that we use mechanics to look at injuries is we go, okay, well, what can this person's joint or muscles currently produce? And what can it currently tolerate doing so, right? Because just because it can do it doesn't mean it's going to be a good idea the next day. So what's currently a good idea? And we'll do that and then make sure that there's no detrimental effects the next day. Everything's okay. Everything seems fine. Now I can slowly scale things up just in exactly the same way I do a beginner. I'm effectively looking at, say this person's an athlete. They are 95% an athlete with a beginner's elbow. And I've just got to make sure that I bear that in mind when I approach that joint. I think you said something very interesting just now where you talked about how progressive overload is not just a matter of using more weight, using heavier dumbbells. And when we look at how I could progress that joint, I could be doing multi-joint stuff where actually I was using a fair bit of load, but that load has very little leverage over the injured joint. I could be doing a chest press with a dodgy elbow, but because of how I've aligned the resistance relative to the elbow joint, or even if I was using a barbell and the intent that I'd used to manipulate friction could reduce the loads being placed on the elbow, and I was still able to use plenty of load with minimal issues taking place at the joint in question. So we use it as a means of progressing a current joint. It's also, if a joint has got a reduced ability to tolerate loads, it's often in certain directions as well, right? So how do we use the application of resistance to make sure that it's not infringing upon any of maybe the reduced abilities to tolerate that load? And how do we start also making sure that an injury doesn't mean that the other joints can't work hard? If I'm using an understanding of mechanics and I know, oh, someone's got a dodgy elbow, well, what if, as opposed to them holding a cable when they were doing a lateral raise, it was something cuffed, either closer to the elbow, because the closer that distance gets, the less stress that gets put on the elbow, or even past the elbow. And now I'm still able to challenge the same stuff in the shoulders with just as much resistance without being held back by the injury that I've got at a different joint. So that's how I'd look at it in terms of rehab. Do you have any questions or follow up on that in particular?
Yeah. So like, well, when it comes to like the rehab stuff, context, I wanted to ask you a bit more going into like the prosthetics and how does exercise mechanics, biomechanics have a play in the design of things like prosthetics or orthotics, for example?
I wish I had an answer for you on that. That's definitely outside my scope of expertise. I basically know nothing about that. So
that's fine. Yeah. So that's
me to provide anything.
No. That's fine. That's cool. Like, that's something else that I really appreciate and I want viewers and listeners to understand as well, is that when a practitioner, no matter what their expertise is, everyone has their own specific niche. And being able to say that I don't know the answer to that, that is also highly beneficial. And I think a lot of people, especially within the fitness industry, like to go out of the scope of practice. So that answer is actually a fantastic answer. So I appreciate that as well.
Well, I spend a lot of time in rooms with very clever people as part of teaching. And so I'd get found out really quickly if I started talking about stuff that I didn't know a lot about. So it's kept me very much in my place. If you live on social media, right, you can just spout whatever you like and ignore the comment section or tell people you can't elaborate on social media and get out of jail free card. But you spend the amount of time that I do in rooms with like the leading personal trainers in each city, and they would make me look a fool very quickly. So I stay in my lane.
Because a lot of those guys are not just educated in specifically personal training. They've got multiple degrees in very different fields, from nutrition to physiology to God knows, mental health, etc. But I appreciate you being 100% honest. So
the athletic application stuff, should I just go into that a little bit quickly?
Yeah, sure. Go for it.
Okay, so with sports performance, the stuff that tends to be a little bit funny is the simplistic industry tendency is to look at a sport and go, oh, in this sport, this person does this movement. Okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to give them a heavy dumbbell and get them to do this movement. And if we don't understand mechanics and directions of resistance, say we took like a tennis racket, right? Tennis racket has a large surface area and they're usually quite light in 2024. So as a result, the majority of the resistance is probably going to be from trying to move the thing through air. And we're then going to see resistance in that direction. If I took a heavy dumbbell, which has minimal surface area, so it's not going to see much resistance and wind friction, but it's quite heavy and as relative to a tennis racket. So the direction of resistance is in this direction. Me doing this might look like a tennis swing, but has minimal carryover and translation to someone being better at swinging a tennis racket. What I've also then got is a massive difference in like the inertial effects, where if I swung a dumbbell like this, that dumbbell wants to keep going and throw me across the room. Whereas if I swung a tennis racket like that, it would have no inclination to do that. So what we try to do is look at the athletic application of exercise and moving things into sports and go, okay, that's integration. That's almost like using the tools that we've given ourselves by improving our strength and function in the gym. And if I look at the joint functions that I'm required to be really good at in that athletic application, how could I break those down into pieces and make someone really good at all of those joint functions. Because if I isolate things as well, I can really push someone close to their limit on those joint functions and see potentially more beneficial adaptation than if they're distracted by having to manage tons of joints at a time. Mm-hmm. I can almost take a bodybuilding lens on these things, but then also not see it as having to be either bodybuilding or playing sports. But this spectrum, this continuum is the term that we use at RTS. We talk about this as being the exercise continuum of exercises that sit everywhere in between. I've got stuff that's super isolated and I've got stuff that's kind of moderately more integrated as I go further and further towards the point where I go, actually, when you're playing your sport, if I start getting you to do that movement with anything other than the tool that you do this with as part of your profession, I could well be interfering with the coordination, the learning that you've gained from playing that sport by screwing with it, by having forces in the wrong direction or a different magnitude of force or different inertial effects. This person's honed that skill by playing that sport. My job is to make them bigger, faster, stronger, more functional. My job is definitely not to injure them, because that's the best way to no longer be a sports performance coach, is to have their coach for their sport actually not send their athletes to me anymore because I've injured one of them. So how can I best achieve all these beneficial outcomes without achieving the one thing that will probably get me fired, and gradually make sure that I'm producing as much of the thing that this person was sent to me for, which is bigger, faster, stronger, all that kind of stuff.
Amazing. Yeah, because this is something that happens on social media all the time. People go with these crazy exercises, and I'm not qualified to make any sort of comment, but even common sense sometimes says to me, there's too much movement happening in this, and surely it's impossible to translate one piece of equipment in the gym into the real life situation. Like, I don't know, that sometimes people go into like a Bosu ball and they end up throwing a kettlebell, thinking that's going to increase their performance for throwing a ball across a field for cricket or for baseball. And it just makes no sense. Even watching it, you think these guys are experts. They work for some of the top clubs. They must know something, right? But yeah, very controversial to say is stuff sometimes on social media.
And the goal for us is with mechanics is to not necessarily say that any of that stuff is wrong, but to really just offer a different perspective and say that is there a possibility that through not just being focused on what this thing looks like and focused on how it might challenge the individual internally, could we improve their internal performance and then see improved external performance when they try and apply that on a sports field?
Amazing. Amazing. Love that. Again, all context and relevance, right?
Exactly.
So next up, I want to ask is, how would you use exercise mechanics in order to contribute to injury prevention and recovery? So now preventing the sort of injuries from happening, especially when it comes to the gym context, whether it be for general population or even for athletes.
So I think you've got two situations under which someone gets injured, right? You've got an acute injury, which is effectively, you know how earlier I mentioned, an injury is when someone has a reduced ability to produce or tolerate force. An acute injury is literally circumstances under which the force applied exceeds what the individual is capable of. So whether that's force applied through a joint at an angle that there's not actually muscle tissue aligned with, so say you went laterally across a knee and you're looking at just connective tissue, how do we make sure that we're ideally not loading knees in that direction when what they're built to move and function in a different direction? So that's a pretty basic way of going, well, how am I aligning forces with the structures and mobility of the joint and matching things up nicely? And at the same time, then making sure that I'm conscious of the effects of changing tempo, because when I manipulate something like tempo, what I'm manipulating is acceleration. And when I manipulate acceleration, I see momentum and inertia and blips in force requirements that could exceed what a joint is capable of or what a muscle is capable of. So how am I understanding things that are going to vary force magnitude or direction? And how am I going to make sure that they're in line with what the individual is capable or tolerant of? And that's going to ensure that I don't find myself in a situation where I have an acute injury. But the stuff, I think you can make a strong case that acute injuries should never take place in a personal training session. Aside from like some freak situation, I don't know, someone sneezes when they're doing a deadlift or something and they, you know, they lose some of their positioning. As a result, they hurt themselves. Like that's out of our control as professionals. But in all other situations, if force has exceeded what an individual is capable of, well, we were the ones who chose how much force was being applied. Yeah. We were the one that chose the pin on the weight stack or gave them those dumbbells. And we were the one whose job it was to only give them that much weight once we'd established that they could control and own that much weight through those ranges. We were the ones whose job it was to make sure that if they didn't have ownership to prevent themselves to say from going back here when they started thinking about what they were having for lunch, how do we put measures in place to make sure that the machine or the cables couldn't go past there? How do we mitigate these circumstances? So I think there's a decent argument to be made that that should never occur in a gym, that no one should be experiencing acute injuries. Chronic injuries, which is where you've got, you know, something being done to the joint over time that it's not too happy about, and you've got almost like this build-up that it can't recover from of stress. Mm. There's something that, again, it's very difficult for us to gain an understanding of from exercise science, but there are clues, right? And there are clues that can often be assessed through a cost-benefit analysis. The easiest one that comes to mind is probably like a behind-the-neck pull-down, right? There's nothing from our understanding of the way the back muscles work, specifically relative to a vertical resistance, that means we're going to see any more stimulus here than we might see here. Some people might find more sensation, but that's primarily because they're retracted. And if you're retracted, some of those muscles might be shorter and you might feel some more like mid-trap stuff. But relative to the stuff that's primarily pulling downwards, that is going to be the primary goal of doing a vertical pulling movement, there's no benefit from being back here that we wouldn't achieve from being in any of these planes. And then if we look at the position that we're putting the shoulder joint in and the limitations we might put on scapular movement and the sleeve of ligaments that wraps around the shoulder and how they're at the very end of their range while we're going through our reps, and we're keeping in mind this thing that we talked about earlier where we're going. So we're repetitively loading stuff in the gym over and over again, 50 reps a week kind of stuff. We need to be almost overly cautious of the stuff that we're doing and pretty strict with this cost benefit type stuff. There's also no exercise that Janet from upstairs, who's 40 and decided that she wants to be able to run around and play with her kids when she's 70, has to do, right? So when we're making this cost benefit analysis, we're going, well, if she can get everything that she needs out of this, why would I put her back here and have her do these? Because I've got the clues to tell me that could be a problem. It might not be, right? There's no guarantee. Just like there's no guarantee that if someone was to smoke cigarettes every day for the rest of their lives, that they wouldn't get lung cancer. We don't know this stuff for sure, but we just have a pretty good idea that this might not be a good idea. And so we go along the lines of, you know what, let's just do all of our pulling work here because that's got a lower potential cost and risk. And it's got, as far as we're aware, just as much benefit.
Yeah, like I always say to my clients, manage risk, manage fatigue. Two very, very, very important factors in there.
I like both of those.
Yeah. So like manage your risk, make sure you don't get an injury. And then if you're managing your fatigue, you don't have to worry about things like deloading, for example. Because I genuinely believe that if someone's deloading, it's because you've got too much volume going in your program and you pushed yourself a little bit too hard. Like people say like, oh, should I deload every 6 weeks? I was like, I've never deloaded in my life. And like, that's because like when I deload, it's when I go on a holiday and I just happen to do a little bit less. And I still managed to find some time, but if you do too much volume, something's going to give in at some point and yeah, prevent that from happening. So yeah, great. Honestly, beautifully said. So moving on from that, can you discuss any recent breakthroughs in exercise mechanics that have particularly excited you? Because there's a lot of stuff that comes up on social media, obviously. And yeah, some stuff just
none of that stuff that you see on social media is a breakthrough. Like yeah. the guys that I work for and hang out with have been teaching this stuff for 35 years. And there's some things that they've learned about. For example, during COVID, they were able to do fluoroscopies, I think is the word, where it's like moving X-rays. And that's kind of interesting, right? They were able to see, oh, how much does the scapula actually stay retracted if you try and maintain retraction while pressing or how much does it actually even move forward or up when someone does a pressing movement in either of those directions? How much does the lumbar spine actually curve when someone does a crunch? All these things. So those were, at the time, the most interesting things that had come out for a while. But any of the stuff that you see on social media, that's like 15-year-old RTS stuff, basically. Now, the only thing that kind of springs to mind at the moment is the work that Tom Purvis has been doing over the past few years in terms of better understanding strength profiles. If you look at the understanding that the industry has in general of it, most of it has come from the work he's done in the past, but he's getting really solid on finding ways to appropriately measure those. And the cool thing about it is he's also finding out ways in which he was not quite on the money as well. So there are, you know, professionals out there thinking that they've got this stuff down, but they've only got it down relative to the previous study that he'd done of it. And yeah. I think there's going to be some really interesting stuff out that he comes out with over the coming few years that gives us a really fun perspective on exactly where we are strong and weak, because that stuff's important if we're going to know how to, if the goal of a personal training session is yielding efficiency, is yielding as much stimulus as possible relative to what a person's capable of tolerating at as little tax as possible, right? You talked about like there being too much volume in someone's program. Well, if my exercise design improves, I can also achieve more stimulus over fewer reps. So I'm having to put this individual through less volume, and that might be the way that I can hopefully progress them over time. And if we've got a better understanding of where their capabilities lie, I can then tailor the resistance to ensure that it's at its max, where they're at their max strength, and then it drops off appropriately in the right portions of the range.
Awesome. Knowledge is like top tier. What a statement to make as well, saying all the stuff on social media is just 15-year-old RTS stuff. That's just
I was being complimentary there. A lot of it's probably
I know. Like, honestly, like I see stuff go viral on social media, and then I see some of you guys post stories, and I wish you guys just had a much bigger platform just so that you could debunk some of the stuff, because yeah, there's a lot of nonsense out there. And again, like, it's managing risk. People see cool exercises and they go ahead and do it. Even from, I won't mention names obviously, but people with hundreds of thousands, if not millions of followers providing false information sometimes. It's a bit scary. So again, moving on from that, even because I'm running out a bit of time now, unfortunately. Okay. So you're talking about the lat pull down variation, and there's a bit of risk going on the back of the head as well. So I was just wondering, are there any exercises you see specifically in the gym context that people are doing incorrectly?
I think that's a really tricky thing to assess, right? It's very difficult to know what an individual's goals are and what their capabilities are as well. And you know, they could have some sport specific reasons why they want their joints to be in certain ranges. So it's quite difficult to make a kind of a blanket assessment. I think if we were looking at just like general population in the gym under most circumstances of looking for maximum benefit at minimum cost, it's not necessarily a few exercises that are done poorly, because I'd say execution is kind of how I'd frame that. And I see that being pretty poor across the board, even by the average personal trainer in a gym, to be quite frank. But the selection and the design of exercises, there's probably a few out there that come to mind, right? You could look at, so a behind the neck pull down, for example, or behind the neck press is just an unnecessary place to be relative to the potential costs. I think you could look at an upright row and say that might represent a risk that is not necessary to achieve stimulus to what? The traps and the deltoids. Like, there are really good exercises for shortening the traps and shortening the deltoids that don't incur the internal rotation and risk of an upright row. You could probably look at something. I tell you what's not a logical design, but usually done quite poorly, that springs to mind, is a Russian twist. Because there, most of the people that do them don't have the prerequisite strength to maintain a kind of neutral-ish spine while they do them. So they end up doing this kind of combination of remaining in flexion because they can't keep their spine straight while they're doing rotation. There's limited stimulus to rotation because the direction of resistance is kind of straight down through you when you're anywhere other than either side. And it's often done with an external performance goal, right? I have less, not how much rotation have I got available in my spine, but can I slam this thing on the floor on either side of me? That's a pretty good example of something where you go, the stimulus is pretty poor. The average person that does that exercise doesn't really have the ability to do it well. And the average intent that is used on an exercise like that is probably not in line with what the goal should be. So that's probably the best example I can come up with.
Like you said earlier as well, you said just because you can doesn't mean you should. And again, that exact statement is a reflection on context, relevance, and then again, managing risk and managing fatigue. Because if you're not, like, what are you putting at risk for potentially no stimulus at all? You're just wasting your time in the gym, and time's pretty important too. So, going to start finishing up now. Got loads of other questions I wish I could ask you, but
sorry, I ranted too much.
Oh no. Honestly, information was so good. So I think I had too many questions. I got a bit ahead of myself. I was a bit too excited probably. So what three key pieces of advice would you give to listeners to adhere to in the gym?
I'd say the thing that runs through my mind whenever I'm sat in a gym watching people work out is slow down. Yeah. There's no reason to do one's reps quickly other than trying to get them done so that you can tick them off on the box and move on to the next exercise. But when reps are quick, the likelihood of us keeping the stuff that's not meant to move still is lower. So our ability to keep good form, right, and consistency of the stuff that is meant to move through whatever path we've chosen for that is probably going to be lower. So we're going to see just less consistency of our reps. We're also going to see less consistency of the stimulus because, as I kind of mentioned earlier with like the forces involved in decelerating and accelerating a mass, we start to see that, you know, if I was doing quick bench presses, for example, quick shoulder presses, the point at the bottom is going to suddenly see way more force than actually the mass that I'm holding should justify. And then when I generate momentum, it suddenly weighs less and then it weighs a lot and I get bouncier and bouncier the quicker I am with an exercise. So I'd say like smooth stops and smooth starts is kind of the phrase that we use at RTS. And if people were just more focused on that control element, I think they'd yield more results and they'd see less tax on their joints because those acceleratory forces that are often happening at the end ranges of a movement are where the joint's also going to experience a lot of tax. So that would be the first one. The second one I'd say would be to have a professional teach you how to use a gym before you decide and go to use a gym. It blows my mind the number of people that take the endeavor of getting fit and using resistance in a gym and applying force to their structure without having considered that there might be a more beneficial or detrimental way to do this. I liken it to just like if you're unwell or if you're looking for some benefits, so just strolling into a doctor's office and grabbing some stuff off the shelf and popping that. The medicine is just like exercise in that it's very individual specific and it's very, we don't just like throw stuff down our gullet and just expect it to help. It really depends on who the person is going to affect whether or not that thing is good for you and what the intended outcome is. And if we're not getting someone who actually understands that stuff to then teach us how to achieve those things with our exercise, we don't know whether or not it could equal. Yeah, we might see some benefits, right? You mentioned earlier about how you can just go into the gym and do any old stuff, bung iron around. Bodybuilders have been doing it for decades, and you will see positive adaptations. The question is, what are you incurring as a result of that? And is that going to mean that you can't go to the gym at some point because of the tax that you've incurred in the process? Or are you also, just like you said, time's valuable, right? If you're going to put this effort into being into the gym, why not make sure that you're being efficient with it? The public has associated personal training with being this thing that you sign up for and you do 3 sessions a week for the next year and it costs you $15,000 or something. And it doesn't have to be that. It can literally just be employing a professional to take you to a gym and show you how to use this stuff without hurting yourself and without incurring either also something chronic over time, and helping you build, you only need like 10, 12 good exercises that work for you across two sessions. And as long as you got better over those for the next 3 months, you'd make plenty of progress, probably without some of the bad stuff that could come along with it. And then if you get bored, which is the main reason to change stuff, you then go and find them and go, hey, could you give me some variations on that? Because I'm watching Instagram every day and I've got the brain of an ADD monkey, so I feel the need to change stuff all the time. Would you give me some new exercises to do? And then they could do that for you. That's the approach that I would take if someone didn't have the, I don't know, the time or the money, whatever, to engage a full-time trainer. At least get someone to show you how to do what you're doing. That's two. The third one, I think, would be to bear in mind why we're in the gym. People, unless you're training for Hyrox or something, and the goal of being in the gym is to get better at moving either yourself or some objects from A to B, you're in the gym for improved internal performance, function, aesthetics, whatever. All of the outcomes that we could see that would be beneficial are just this stuff moving better, operating better, stronger, looking better, all that kind of stuff. That is not dependent on how many times you can move something in the gym from A to B. That's dependent on how much tension and, as a result, stimulus and stress you can put on these things without necessarily putting too much of it on these things. And as a result, the goal, if I was doing a pressing movement, should be, can I make sure that I'm engaging this stuff and using this stuff to get me from A to B, as opposed to just moving this thing from A to B, because that's not in line with my goal. My goal is improved internal performance. And if I want to then do some stuff which like mixes that into external performance, right? We're not all trying to be bodybuilders. Janet from earlier still wants to be able to get tea out of the cupboards when she's 70, right? So there's elements of being able to use this stuff for external performance, but we need to be a bit more intentional with it, I think, and delineate between, okay, what is the goal of this exercise that I'm doing right here? Am I trying to improve and train the stuff that operates me, or am I trying to practice using that in everyday or some like slightly more fun or engaging surroundings?
Perfect. Honestly, so good. So many people, well, trainers in particular, I feel like to do what they like to do and give that to their clients, as opposed to actually listening to their clients. Maybe in the beginning they'll do some specific movements for them, but because the knowledge is not very great when you do like a level 3 personal training, for example. So that's why something like what you guys do is so valuable. And I think it's something that a lot of PTs tend to overlook, because nutrition world is taking over. People just look on social media and they go, that's easy, I'm going to give that to my client, not realizing the risks involved in that exactly. So
yeah, I strongly agree with your premise and thought process behind being objective about this stuff. It's something that I think a lot of people don't realize when they take this on as a profession, is everything that you do outside of here to, you know, look the part and represent yourself and your business well, is irrelevant to the person in front of you. And they provide us with great context and great understandings and great practice for going, okay, well, how can I work on getting inside the mind of the person that's in front of me if I haven't been there myself? Mm-hmm. But that's really, you know, when it comes to actually the design and the prescription of this stuff, that's where that should end. I completely agree with you on that one.
Yeah, it's people, PTs, trainers really can sometimes not understand the amount of influence we have on people's lives. If we tell our clients they need to eat X food, if we tell our clients they have to do X exercise, X amount of steps, chances are they're going to at least try their absolute best to do it because they trust us. But yeah, just to finish off, I just wanted to again say thank you so much. Your knowledge, all the information that you've given out, is there are so many golden nuggets there. We're going to have loads of notes from all of that. So thank you so much. But now I also just would like you to maybe pass on your details to the listeners, where they can find you, social media, contact forms, etc.
Sure. I mean, it's a similar place to where I think where you found me, right? I am the exercise educator on Instagram. If you want to find our business, where we teach RTS outside of the US and the UK, or the Americas and the UK, but also you can find RTS in the Americas and the UK on separate websites as well, which are linked on the RTS Global website. That's at rts.global or rtsglobal.org if you're old school and you're on a web browser. But yeah, for social media stuff, The Exercise Educator and rts.global.
Amazing. Thank you. Everybody follow it. Follow them. Promise you. You'll learn a lot. Cool. Thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Appreciate it, Rich. Thanks, man.
Thank you for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you found it useful, please share with a friend. They would also benefit from these talks. If you'd like to keep up with everything else I get up to, you can check out my Instagram @rich_performance_nutritionist. And feel free to drop me a message.